We will get back to our conversation with Susan Lindauer and your calls as well as we discuss her embarrassing revelations, really, in Extreme Prejudice. The Iraq War, what was it all about? If it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction, if it can be easily proven that Iraqi intelligence did not meet with one of the 9/11 co-conspirators, Mohammed Atta, in Prague. There was no connection there. If Iraq was willing to bend over backwards to essentially surrender to the United States, then why the war? Why 5,000, nearly 5,000 U.S. men and women killed in Iraq, millions of Iraqis, $4 trillion, one quarter of the present U.S. deficit, or debt, rather. What was it all about? A simple vendetta? We'll find out on the other side. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. All right, Susan, before we dive into the calls, let me get your take on what was the Iraq War all about then? Was it a simple business deal, a vendetta against a former business partner? What was it all about?
It was a vendetta by George Bush, Jr. He wanted to prove, he wanted to finish Daddy Bush's war. There was so much profit to be had. We could have had all the oil, a huge peace dividend. The CIA had struck a hard bargain, and all of the things that we wanted to do that were possible, that were very simple to do, that could have been achieved, would have made the war completely ridiculously stupid. And everybody knew it. A lot of, like, James Baker and Brett Scowcroft came out against the war. The Joint Chiefs came out against the war. I actually gave a briefing to the Joint Chiefs sideways in Daryl Issa's office. I gave a debriefing with Daryl Issa, Congressman Daryl Issa, standing in the doorway with one of the Joint Chiefs and staff sitting on the couch while I spoke very loudly with the legislative assistant. And so Daryl Issa, God bless his heart, made it possible for the Joint Chiefs to hear what this peace option. They knew about the peace option, and Daryl Issa did it in such a way that was discreet so that he was not on record of having heard it himself, though he did hear it. And it was really great. He you know, not all Republicans were bad. Some, Daryl Issa was a good Republican, and he put the soldiers first. But the profits were available regardless of whether you went to war or not. You didn't have to do anything. The problem was that Dick Cheney's profits, Halliburton profits, KBR, Blackwater, those profits, the military industrial profits, Lockheed Martin wasn't going to get any money. Those were the profits that they decided mattered more than Detroit, than all the other things that we were going to do. All the oil profits were available. The reason that people don't know the truth, and you can see it's vast, the lies, the disinformation are vast. But what makes this a real crime is not the stupidity of the decision, but the lack of courage and conviction to take responsibility for that decision, the lack of character. George Bush was a weak man. Because when things went wrong almost immediately, he immediately said, well, I don't want to be to blame. You can't hold me responsible. I'm the White House. I'm the President of the United States of America. I'm the Commander-in-Chief. Somebody else has to take the blame for this. And so he turned around and he blamed, when 9/11 was so horrific, he blamed the intelligence community for not knowing about 9/11, though I personally telephoned the office of John Ashcroft on August 8th, and I asked for an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies seeking any fragment of intelligence that would be reported back on airplane hijackings with a known target of the World Trade Center. Though we could see that the war in Iraq was going to be met with violent resistance, and this was told up front. I took the peace option. I'm not a passive person. I took the peace option up to Congress throughout the year 2002. I took it to Jane Harman, who was the committee chair on the Democrat side of the House Intelligence Committee. Jane Harman later lied to the whole world and said, oh, if only there'd been options to war. Gosh, if the CIA had just presented some options. Well, her chief of staff and legislative director had sat there in awe with their jaws open, you know, kind of with fear in their eyes as I told them about this peace option.
You also mentioned that the Syrian
embassy. Sure, everybody knew. I wasn't just sitting. I live 20 minutes from Capitol Hill. I can be down there in 30, 40 minutes.
Right. You mentioned also that the Syrian ambassador made an 11th hour plea for the U.S. to, you know, to stop this this war, and was told it's too late.
Didn't wait until the very end. I made sure that everybody on Capitol Hill knew. And the reason that they are so frightened of me, and this really explains a lot of why they have savagely attacked my reputation and tried to say, oh, maybe she's incompetent. Maybe there's something wrong with her. And that's why I'm going to post the psych reports on Coast to Coast, if you will let me do it. We'll talk about that later, after the show. But I'm going to put that out there so your listeners can make an informed decision about what I'm saying to you and what kind of person I am.
All right, let's dive into the calls. Let's say hi to Jeff in Culver City, California, calling in on the Wild Card line. Jeff, welcome to Coast.
Hi, Richard and Mrs. Lindauer. Yes, this 9/11 mystery is very puzzling, and I'm sure we'll never know the real story, the true story. But I've always been curious about that last plane which crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. This was the last plane, which should have been the first if it was supposedly headed towards Washington, D.C., and when it did, quote-unquote, crash, there was little or no debris field, unlike that plane which recently crashed in France, which left a debris field that took weeks to clean up. My question is this, Mrs. Lindauer. Why do you think the last plane was not the first to attack Washington, since that's the seat of power? And why was there no extensive debris field when it did crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania? And I'll take your answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Go ahead, Susan. Yes.
Okay. The answer is I don't think there was a plane. I think that the flight that was supposedly crashed in Shanksville actually landed in Cleveland, and the mayor of Cleveland, or God, Cleveland or Cincinnati, went out to the mayor of the city.
It was Cleveland. I remember that. Yes.
In Cleveland, yes. Went out and greeted the passengers as they got off the plane. And then the plane continued to be in commission for several years until like something like 2004. Barbara Honegger is a superior source of intelligence on the Pentagon flight and the Shanksville flight. Anyone who wants to research this should look at Barbara Honegger's stuff. She's got great stuff, great intelligence.
What of the passengers then? If they landed in Cleveland, what happened?
They got off the plane and went about their business. But again, this is a mythos that's being created. The corporate media, at the time of the World Trade Center attack, firefighters were reporting that they heard explosions, boom, 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 bam, 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 going off all through the buildings, long after, you know, the planes had hit the buildings. They could hear the explosions. Firefighters are trained to listen to the sound of fire. They know what an explosion sounds like, and they know where it's coming from. And they were reporting this, and yet the corporate media has erased that truth from the official story. They've just wiped the slate of it. And nowadays, you know, the Martha Raddatz crowd, we'll look at you with a straight face and say, no, that didn't happen. And the Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters and all of those people will just, I am Barbara Walters and I'm telling you, trust me, I have integrity. And a lot of Americans, they believe it. And yet that's not what happened. And nobody, when on the day of the event, Nobody said that was what happened. It's only afterwards that we've erased the history.
All right, let's say hi
propaganda.
Let's say hi to Mark in Oregon on the Wild Card line. Mark, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the line with Susan Lindauer.
Well, thank you, Richard, and good evening to you and Susan. I follow the whole program, and it's all familiar territory to me. Jeff, who just called just a moment ago, your previous caller, he said we probably never know the truth of 9/11, basically what happened, what really happened. I would like to go over just a short chain of events and happenings, two or three things here that relate to what's been discussed in a good bit of detail relative to Iraq, Ms. Lindauer, because, of course, you were personally involved in that whole scenario. We go back to the Project for a New American Century.
Yes.
1997, 1998. Dick Cheney, before he became vice president, of course, he was the head of that think tank. Now, we have Jeb Bush, who was also a part of it, Paul Wolfowitz, Mr. Fife, Daniel Fife, I believe, and several others who came into the Bush Jr. administration, into the State Department level, basically. And they were coordinating quite a bit of what Ms. Lindauer was actually doing her very best to counteract relative to making Iraq the patsy for 9/11. Now, by the way, Project Bojanka, I think quite possibly it could have been an actual coincidence. There was another plot similar to 9/11 being cooked up by some terrorists in the Philippines. But I think
except it was Ramzi Joseph, the guy that Joseph that did the initial deed in 93. So that would strain credulity that there was a coincidence.
Yeah. Well, then it could add plausibility if it was arranged basically to come out later on after the event. As to the true perpetrators, again, the Project for a New American Century said that in order to carry out the foreign policy that was recommended by the think tank, which was to go into, I think, about six Middle Eastern countries, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, I believe Yemen, Egypt, Syria, and you can see where they've been really working on getting these countries. They got a few of them, and they almost got a few others, and that's where we're at right now, basically.
I believe Serbia was also on the list, according to Wesley Clark.
Yeah.
It was Libya, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Yemen.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
So that in order, the think tank Project for a New American Century, Dick Cheney heading it, the order in which these countries would be taken, they've pretty much gone down the line with them so far, I think you'll notice. But in order to actually get the sentiment of the American people to follow along with invading, getting in foreign entanglements unnecessary and such like this, if they would need an event that would be similar to Pearl Harbor, like Pearl Harbor was the language used, in order to galvanize the American people, just as Pearl Harbor was used to galvanize the American people, and it was totally contrived, as we learned years later, with the codes being known from the Japanese Navy, several days ahead of time at least, that they were coming in for the attack, and it was allowed to happen. And the dissimilarity between Pearl Harbor and the 9/11 attack is that actually we have traitors within our own country who didn't just let it happen, they actually perpetrated it. Now,
absolutely.
When you go to Norman Mineta's testimony to the 9/11 Commission on February 22nd, I believe, 2002, under sworn testimony, and I've heard the recording, and the transcript is available, as well as the recording on the internet. And actually, George Norrie, I called several months ago and related this to George, what Norman Mineta had to say on that day to the 9/11 Commission under sworn testimony, and that is that he was in the presidential bunker on the grounds of the Naval Observatory, and that the military liaison from the Strategic Air Command was coming in and reporting the distances to the so-called plane, which was really a Global Hawk missile that hit the Pentagon. And the attaché was getting very concerned because the distance was getting very short. And he asked Mr. Cheney on about the fourth time in, sir, does the order still stand? Well, Mr. Cheney said, yes, of course the order still stands, expletive, have you heard any different? And Mr. Cheney took away the authority of the SAC command generals several months before 9/11 and delegated them to himself. And he had the so-called legal authority to actually do what he did on 9/11. This is a smoking gun, and this is the man behind the smoking gun, and the people behind him are the group which perpetrated this, and most or all of them are to be found in the Project for a New American Century group. Now, here we have—
I agree with what you're saying, and I would add one thing about the PNAC, that there is an intention to create a, quote, greater Israel. And I don't know how Coast to Coast Radio feels about this particular subject, but it is a design to create a greater Israel that would destabilize the Arab countries and break them up and instead of fighting against Israel, they'll be battling against each other. And of course, the tragedy, as an anti-war person, I see this, that nobody ever stops to think of how this is going to impact on the ground. And it's one thing to start a war. What we're finding is that it is very difficult to stop it. And we have done this. We have armed ISIS. We have created the monstrosity. We've trained them. We've financed them. We've given them weapons. They're using American supplies. And they're working with our allies in Turkey to penetrate, going back and forth because of some crazy desire to take out President Assad of Syria. Now, I don't know about your politics on this, but I will tell you as a Middle East expert, a lot of people get confused between President Assad and his father.
That's
Hafez
correct,
al-Assad
yes.
was a cruel man.
Right.
President Assad, Bashar Assad, was trained in London to be an ophthalmologist. He's a very open, Western-focused, secular Arab, and this is a kind of, I must insist, this is a crazy mistake. Killing off Assad would be like killing the Archduke Ferdinand before World War I. Assad is the only thing standing in the way of the Arabs attacking Israel. And so, ironically, the PNAC crowd, the Project for the New American Century, is trying to destabilize the Middle East so that the Arabs will fight each other. But the Arabs are interactive as well, and they see that they're using the United States to take out the last secular wall, the breach. Once they've got Syria, they will have an open road straight into Israel. And that's
all right,
what
I've
they're going for.
Got to take a time out here. We'll take more of your calls with Susan Lindauer. Extreme Prejudice, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett. Welcome back. Last half hour of the program. Wow, where did it go? All right, back to more of my conversation and your calls for Susan Lindauer, Extreme Prejudice, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Title of your book, Extreme Prejudice. Now, that term, you know, from the spy world, to go back to the 3 days of the Condor, that extreme prejudice usually means a visit from someone maybe resembling Max von Sydow. In other words, a wet team, assassination,
yes.
Take you out. But they didn't do that to you. And they could
oh,
have.
They did. What they did was what they tried to do. They actually locked me on a military base, and they refused to give me a trial. They arrested me I'm glad we're talking about this now. A big part of my book is about the Patriot Act. I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act after Jose Padilla. I was subjected to secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. I was never allowed to know who had accused me of what crime. It was actually Colin Powell who accused me of coming to him. I went to him twice before his speech at the United Nations, telling him that the Iraqi exiles were fabricating intelligence. This is where it becomes the Bush policy on Iraq becomes a crime, because what they did was they deputized the bureaucracy to commit felony perjury in a court of law to deny my identity. And everybody knew who I was. They knew what I had done. But what they desperately did not want me to have a trial where all of this would be aired and the 9/11 warnings would come out and all of the, you know, the evidence against me was sparse, to say the least. It was very, very thin. They had receipts for three lunches totaling $92.92 in Manhattan with an Iraqi diplomat. And it was questionable whether I was even the right Susan, because the diplomat had a girlfriend named Susan, and it's very possible that he had those three lunches with her. But that was the only evidence they had against me. Three receipts totaling $92.92. Hardly anything to send somebody to federal prison for, unless you're desperately trying to destroy their reputation. Well, once I was locked up, they pleaded with the court. We had a hellacious fight to try to, I had to stop them from forcibly drugging me. And they wanted to chemically lobotomize me. They literally argued that I should be forcibly injected with Haldol, Ativan, and Prozac until I could be cured of stating that my witnesses would confirm that I had been a CIA asset and that I gave advance warning about 9/11. And of course, I had civilians who would come into court too. And I had, you know, I had a witness list. I had attorneys from the Lockerbie trial in Scotland who were willing to come over at their own expense to testify in court in New York. And these were not American citizens associated with the CIA who could be controlled. These were attorneys, highly credible witnesses from the Lockerbie case, who would easily establish that I was in fact the woman I said I was, and that I had been working with Richard Fuz for a long time in the Middle East. And the CIA had declared that Richard Fuz was a major intelligence asset, and that anything tied to Richard would be classified. So Richard's ability to talk was very limited, but I had corroboration from other sources. So they actually argued that I should be forcibly drugged. And that was the scariest part. Getting locked in prison for a year was itself, you know, it's not pleasant. You don't ever want to go to prison. Don't ever do it. You know, don't break the law, young man. Live a good life, or don't go to jail. I agree. Okay. But the problem is that you have political prosecutions, and then you have the inconvenient truth, which is devastating to the Republican Party and to Democrats like Jane Harman and Dianne Feinstein, very powerful Democrats. Nancy Pelosi, don't think she's one of the good guys just because she's not a Republican. They're all the same now. They have morphed into one party, and they have one objective, and that is their own survival. They don't care about us. They don't know what to do. They've created a mess, and they lack the courage. They lack the responsibility and character to take responsibility for their own actions. And this is actually becoming a very serious problem, because they make very stupid decisions and they don't want to be held responsible for it. But at this point, right here, when they arrest me, they arrested me 30 days after I requested to testify on Capitol Hill about the real story of what I've just told you tonight. And I woke up to hear the FBI pounding on my door. And I looked out, I thought they were at the wrong house. I said, why are you here? You know, I was getting out of bed to make coffee the morning. I was just, you know, I wasn't a bank robber or a murderer. They said, you are arrested on the Patriot Act. So it wasn't until later, a couple of hours later, that I even knew what I was charged with. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of in my life. And then I realized how frightened they were. And I thought that I recognized that I could beat them in court very easily. And that, but then I determined that I immediately, you know whether you're going to fight or not. And I'm a fighter. I'm a real fighter. I mean, if they can do this to me, given how hard I'm capable of fighting and beating them back, then imagine what they could do to you.
Aren't you still a threat to the war party, though? Aren't you still a threat to the war party and speaking out like this? I mean,
yes. Yes, I am. And in a Jeb Bush candidacy, I expect that they will come on hard and the propaganda will start flying. They're already testing whether they can get away with it. And that's why I was so pleased when Coast to Coast Radio asked for me to come on, because this is a very important moment where we need to remind people, even though this war happened 10 years ago, given that ISIS is fighting now, we need to hold these people responsible, and you need to know where the crimes committed were committed, because this was a malicious cover-up to hide truth and responsibility from the American people using criminal means. They literally deputized bureaucracy to commit crimes against the American people, to commit felony perjury, to make false arrests and false imprisonment.
Let me get back to the phones here. And John is on the wild card line in St. Louis. John, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Ms. Lindauer, on this Memorial Day weekend, it's an honor to be with the spirit of patriotism of our forefathers, to speak the truth and speak truth to power. Thank you for your courage. I'm familiar with your work and listened to you and posted over and over on my Facebook page your videos. I want to know if you have a speaking, if you do speaking tours around the country. If you came to St. Louis, I would do my best to sponsor you. And what can we as Americans do? I am a part of the Architects for 9/11 Truth. What can we do as Americans to support you, Ms. Lindauer? We love you so much. Thank
you, that is so kind of you. I expect that in the presidential election campaign, I am in the next campaign with Jeb Bush running and Hillary Clinton running, I will be excoriated again. You see how powerful and important truth is for an educated public, an educated electorate, to make better choices and to throw the bums out. We have got to clean out the entire dead weight on both sides of the aisle. These people are hurting our society. And they don't have solutions to our problems. They don't know what to do. They're making bad decisions, and they're refusing to listen to us. They refuse to listen to us. They do whatever they want to do, and then they turn around and they can't even take they don't even have the character to take responsibility for their actions. So then they arrest us. And this is where the government becomes very, very scary. The Jade Helm issue, I remember, I just want to say one thing about that. 4 months before my arrest, my father and I were having a conversation. My father is a Zionist. He's 80 years old. He's a PNAC kind of crowd kind of guy, but he's an old man. And so, I get that. But before my arrest, my father was saying that I was hysterical. I was overreacting to the Patriot Act. That would only apply to foreigners. They were only going to look at the communications and do surveillance of international phone communications, and it was never going to affect anyone inside the United States. And I said, Father, once you've got a law on the books, it applies to every American citizen, and nobody has the right to strip out constitutional rights of American citizens. He said, no, you're wrong. Well, of course, I was supposed to be I was overreacting, he said. 4 months later, I'm under arrest on the Patriot Act, and my father is now terrified of the government, thinking that, we remember this conversation. You see,
well, government,
And you're going to look back on the Jade Helm conversation in maybe a year. It's not going to happen in September. I don't think that, I truly don't believe there's going to be martial law in September.
No,
but
no.
Maybe next September, maybe 18 months from now, and then we will all look back on Jade Helm and we will recognize that it is a precursor. It is a training seminar. They don't train unless they intend to use it. That's the problem. They don't put laws on the books like the NDAA unless they intend to use it. And they are going to at some point. They just haven't done it yet.
Well, we are in a situation where citizens are afraid of their government, and it's supposed to be the other way around. When a government's afraid of the people, that's democracy. When it's flipped over, head over heels, you've got tyranny. Let's say hi to Josie in Wisconsin. Welcome to Coast, Josie.
Yes, good morning. You do a wonderful job, Richard. And to me, my original question was to ask if Colin Powell was in the loop, you know, or duped when he made that speech and you brought that up. But also, I'm a senior citizen, and I look back on history, and none of these kinds of people, these evil people, have ever had to have ever gotten their comeuppance, you know, as they say. And I don't know what it's gonna. I just have a feeling that it's gonna take some kind of revolution, you know. It's just so incredible and overwhelming. You know, I'm surprised that something hasn't happened to you, Ms. Lindauer. It's just, I don't understand what's going on with humanity, honestly.
She wants to know about Colin Powell. Was he duped?
This is very important. Colin Powell should, I want to go on record saying this here. Colin Powell deserves to be court-martialed for lying to his fellow officers and degrading the security of the United States military and sabotaging the constitutional rights of an American citizen who is not in the military in order to protect his lie. And that is because I personally, Colin Powell on September 8th, 2005, gave an interview to Barbara Walters on 2020 saying, blaming mid-level intelligence people for not coming to him before his speech at the United Nations. On September 17th, now that interview was September 8th, September 17th, the federal government, Justice Department, rubber-stamped an order that I would be declared incompetent to stand trial. And on September 23rd, I was ordered to appear in a courtroom where I was ambushed with an order to surrender to prison for a psychiatric evaluation on October 3rd. So right at the moment that Colin Powell was launching his media bid to save his reputation and whitewash the blood and the dirt from this war and American soldiers off his uniform, I was being ordered to go to prison so that I would be out of the way and I could not contradict the nonsense story that he was inventing. That's how scary these people are, that they actually think like that. If I can have her sent to prison, she'll be out of my way and then I can lie to everybody. I mean, but in point of fact, I had gone to Colin Powell and the prosecution, the Justice Department had Bates stamped the documents for my prosecution. I had gone to him on January 8th and January 27th, giving him January 8th. I gave him the peace option, there are handwritten notes to the secretary saying, you know, this peace option is still valid. If there's anything that you need me to do, we can still make this happen, and you can accomplish all of your goals and save the lives of American soldiers from a position of strength. We can win. We can win even now. We can do this today. And then on January 27th, I went back to him and I said, please, sir, I don't mean to be rude to you, but the Iraqi exiles are fabricating intelligence. They are notorious liars. They are desperate to enlist the support of U.S. soldiers in their defense because they are so hated inside Iraq. There is no way that they can go back and run the country unless they have American soldiers pointing guns at the Iraqi people. I said, please do not be angry at me for saying this truth to you. You need to hear this from somebody who's actually dealing with the Iraqi people. You are being fed bad intelligence. And I corrected him. He turned that over to the FBI, and he said, arrest this woman. I want her out of my way. He's a dirty crook. And it's not a mistake at that point. It is a dirty, crooked, dishonest, felonious. It's a criminal action at that point.
Are you prepared to go back to prison, Susan? If it comes to that?
Well, they have dropped the charges. Were dismissed with prejudice, meaning that they can never be imposed again 5 days before Obama's inauguration. But they thought,
could they not come up with some new charge? Could they not come up with some new charge?
Oh,
did they even need a charge? I mean, we've got rendition. We've got secret prisons.
We've got rendition and NDAA. We've got NDAA. I would say I'm on the category for NDAA. Yeah.
Explain what is that?
The National Defense Authorization Act, where they
right.
can lock people in on a military basis without a trial, without charges, without a crime being committed on the basis that a future action might occur predicated on previous behavior.
All right, Susan, I can say is, be well, stay safe, and I hope to talk to you again.
I really enjoyed this. And everybody, please, if you want to support me, the best way you can do that is to get educated. please read my book, Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. You'll get vast intelligence on Iraq and the Middle East, and you'll also get a real story of the Patriot Act, which we have not had a chance to talk about, and what it was like to be locked up in a military base. And how my family was, when my family and my attorneys would show up to visit me, they were turned away. They were told that there was
okay.
no prison on the base,
etc. Susan, we got to run. I appreciate your time again. Extreme Prejudice. For George Norrie, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Dan Galante, Tim Binal, Gina Selvati, and here in Toronto, Luke Cameron, Scotty Guest, and Gord Harris, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your voices, your beautiful voices. Good night.